Welcome, everybody, to Space Force. I am Jason Tondra.
I'm Jim Seals.
And I am Aid Smith.
And we are here for a double-length, giant-size episode of Space Force. Last week, I was in Miami, Ohio, for Recon, a wonderful little gaming convention put on by the League of Geeks at the Miami University in Ohio. And they have a wonderful game design program there. I got to meet with the students. We did kind of a workshop where we broke open a Starfinder adventure and kind of designed all the encounters and all the skill challenges and treasure and stuff. And we did a panel and things like that. It was super fun, but it meant that we were not able to record at our usual time. So now we are back in with a lot to do because those were two like really insane episodes. So. Yeah.
McCall may have said engage in the third episode, but he really meant it for the fifth and sixth episode.
Yeah, no doubt. So very brief recap now. We have the first half that we're going to talk about is the Stardust City Rag, which will forever be known as the 7 of 9 episode or the French Pirate Picard episode, maybe.
Yes.
And this is the one in which the heroes, the protagonists, finally reach Maddox on apparently a sort of what passes in Star Trek for a vicious hive of scum and villainy. And it's this planet of Free Cloud. And Seven, at first, offers herself as essentially a trading barter chip to get Maddox back. But then as soon as we all get together in one room with the woman who's running things and actually has Maddox, and somebody help me out with pronouncing her name. I have BJAYZL.
I thought it was Bajazel.
Bajazel. Okay.
But unfortunately, I wasn't only able to watch the episodes once.
I saw her, I thought, holy shit, it's like young Deanna Troi.
Oh, I thought it was Beta Zoe. I just told Misty. I was like, this looks exactly like Deanna Troi in the first episode in the pilot.
Yeah,
the towel of hair on that.
Yeah,
it was definitely a double take to see if it actually was her. It's like, is that? It's like, crikey. And okay, yeah.
I'm not convinced that she's not a Betazoid, right? I mean, we haven't been told.
Yeah, that's true.
So she could, but anyway, Bajazel, and in the flashback scene for this episode, we saw Bajazel disassembling a recurring character from Voyager, whose name was Aichip.
Icheb. Yeah.
We're going to talk about Icheb. But he was a Borg who was reformed, an escaped Borg, and Bajazel was taking apart his cybernetic elements. And then he has a very tender moment when Seven appears and tries to rescue him, but he essentially asks for help to die, and so she mercy kills him. She euthanizes him with a phaser. But anyway, so when we get when we're all in the room together with Bajazel and Seven and Picard and everybody, it becomes clear that Seven's actual imperative here is to murder Bajazel and get revenge. And there's a lot of, you were lying all this time? Yeah, and so are you, kind of back and forth between everybody, which ends with Maddox being taken back to the ship and everything seemingly fine. Until Jurati at last exposes her traitorous nature, which we have been talking about since episode 2.
Mm-hmm.
And she murders Maddox in sickbay after he's already told Picard about Soji's existence on the artifact. Meanwhile, with a little help from our captain.
Captain Rios.
Yeah, Captain Rios. The little help from Captain Rios. Seven takes a couple of phasers and beams back down. There's a moment that we'll probably talk about when Seven and Jean-Luc are both talking about their experiences as a reformed or recovered Borg. And we'll share that. We'll talk about that and their sort of shared experience there. But then she transports back down to the planet and proceeds to murder everyone, including Bajazel, with a disintegrator blast. And the episode ends with Maddox's death, I think.
Yeah.
Then we skip ahead to the second episode that broadcast just a few days ago, The Impossible Box. And there we pick back up on the Romulan artifact on the Borg cube, which we did not see anything of in the Stardust City Rag. And as everybody kind of comes together, so Picard and the crew arrive at the Borg artifact. And we forgot to talk about Raffi. Raffi has apparently went to Free Cloud so she could try to reunite with her son. But after her son told her to get lost, she's back on the ship and smoking and drinking again. And
is drunk for much of the second episode.
Yeah, she's pretty wasted for the second episode. But she manages to get them the diplomatic credentials that they need by alienating yet another one of her old friends. And they get onto the artifact, only Picard is allowed on the artifact. And Picard reunites with Hugh. We have a great couple of scenes with Hugh, which I found very interesting because we learn what does Hugh want in all of this, which we'll talk about. Meanwhile, Narek is getting Soji close to recognizing herself. And he does it with this very interesting Romulan meditation room, which reminded me very much of another thing that I want to bring up. But in the process of going through the meditation room, she figures out, she is able to break through into her memories, and Narek is able to find out the clues that he needs to find out where the synthetic homeworld, apparently because they have one, is. Picard and Soji and everyone, Narek tries to kill Soji, but she escapes, unites with Picard and Hugh, and they're about to get mobbed by Romulans when our hero, our savior, the cavalry, I've forgotten his name.
Which one?
The Romulan. My friends choose to live.
Oh, Elnor.
Elnor shows up after he's been told not to leave the ship. He appears, kills a bunch of Romulans, and holds off the bad guys long enough for Picard and Soji to apparently go through basically an intergalactic transporter. Like, they basically walk through this gate, and it sends them across known space to some other planet. Do we know where that planet is? Is it familiar to anyone?
Yeah, that's in the Voyager episode Prime Factals, which is in season one.
Wow.
Voyager, I think. And it's the basic conceit of the episode was Voyager encountered a race with their own prime directive. And they could have gotten home like halfway in like a day. And instead, they sort of have to slink away and be like, well, we have to respect you guys because we also have a similar decree.
All right. Well, so we end up with the breaking of the fellowship. We have Picard and Soji on this remote planet. We've got Hugh and Elnor fending off a horde of attacking Tal Shiar. And we've got Rios and Jurati and Raffi on the
La Sona.
Yeah, and on their ship, the Serena. And that's kind of where everybody is at the end of that episode. So, lots went on, and more things that we haven't talked about. It was a long summary; it took us twice as long. So maybe we should start with Stardust City Rag. What did you guys think? First thoughts, or anything in particular, in all of that you want to make sure that we maybe dig in on right away?
Can we pull back a little bit and just talk about the two episodes globally?
Yeah, of course.
So I think globally, with these two episodes and the structure of it, I think Star Trek Picard finally structurally makes sense.
Well, I don't think it's a coincidence that we get to the cube at the beginning of six, right? Yeah. Like, we find out, we have a 10-episode length.
Mm-hmm.
The first five episodes are finding out where Soji is and getting to her.
Mm-hmm.
And the next six is, okay, now what do we do with her?
Yeah. Well, structurally, like, remember in episode two, I was struggling with the flashback. Like, why are we seeing this flashback? What does the flashback mean? Like, all the other flashbacks have made more sense in terms of, like, the connectedness to the rest of the episode. And episode 6 is the first episode we don't open with a flashback.
We don't have one in 6?
We don't have a flashback in 6. We start in media red. Like, 6 we start with, like, Rios on the ship, and he's playing soccer.
Yeah, right.
And it's the moments after Bruce Maddox is forgive me. It's the scene where Girardi talks to Picard, and Picard has that moment where he gets that false contact file in him and then has a panic attack. Okay. So structurally speaking, Picard is a show dealing with trauma.
Yep.
So not just Picard the character, like Starfleet deals with trauma because they have the trauma of the Maul's attack. Romulans are dealing with trauma because they have the supernova. Seven of Nine is dealing with trauma because she's betrayed by a potential lover who killed her son.
Yeah.
Eleanor's dealing with his trauma, and they're doing macro traumas and micro traumas. Eleanor's dealing with the trauma of being abandoned by a surrogate father figure.
Yep. Yep.
Like all these like things are going on, and Six is we've shown the audience all the trauma. And I predict that from 6 to 10, we won't be getting much flashbacks, if at all, because now we've outlined what the trauma is all. We're going to be showing characters dealing with the trauma.
You're right. This is a show about dealing with trauma. At least the first season is.
Yeah.
Because Rios is also recovering from trauma, the death of his XO.
And so is Raffi.
But we haven't seen Rios's flashback yet. And I really expect to. I expect to see him on the ship. Mm-hmm. His captain die.
Yeah. I don't know if we will. I'm just thinking like in terms of like we're not gonna see Raffi like ignoring her son for X number of years. Like that was sort of encapsulated within the dialogue.
Yep.
So I kind of think we have like main sort of characters, and if they interact with Picard closely, like Eleanor is, you have to see that rift, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Versus like Rios, like if it's totally devoid of the main structure of the plot, I think it's not going to factor in as heavily.
So Rios's trauma is not linked to Picard, therefore we will not see it.
Yeah, that's my thinking in terms of structurally speaking, because everything like and all the characters are having different reactions, right? Raffi is losing herself in the bottle. Rios has isolated himself with himself to recriminate himself, right, on his ship.
Yeah.
Interestingly,
Girardi's trauma we are seeing happen live.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Going from someone who doesn't like violence to someone who has to kill a level. And then, like, Picard has to have his quest. Like, Picard has to have something to do. Like, he can't just be the old man sitting on the vineyard. He's done that for 14 years, and it hasn't worked out. So now he has his mission.
Well, and also I think they're emphasizing, I mean, certainly in the Impossible Box, we see a lot of his struggle with Borg trauma.
Mm-hmm. And he has a panic attack, like the captain of, like the quintessential Starfleet officer. Like he's, like everyone's like, yeah, we can have the Picard debate. But honestly, when you think of what a Starfleet captain is, it's going to be, the image is John Luke, right?
Well, that's why people like Kirk, is because he breaks the rules.
Mm-hmm.
He's the Han Solo of Federation captains.
Yeah, and we see him actually having a panic attack. He like isolates himself in his holodeck cabin just to get a hold of himself.
Yeah.
And he has another panic attack in public.
Yeah.
Like when Hugh shows up, and he was finally the only person in this entire show who's been excited to see Picard. He smiles at Picard.
Yeah.
Like the actor was just given this wonderful gift. Like everyone's angry at Picard, and you get to be the one character on the show so far who's excited and happy and energetic. And to allude to a mission going forward, which is Picard debating for the rights, you know, being an advocate for the rights of ex-Borg.
Yeah, I read a very brief article that mentioned how the script couldn't decide how Hugh and Jean-Luc would greet each other. And the hug was created on the set between the two characters. Like let's hug. Okay, yeah, let's hug.
No one's done that before. No one's done that in this entire show. No one has hugged the old man.
Yeah.
And just to see that and to be like, And the fact that they have that hug and it is so tender and moving and genuine, like the actors are really giving it their all, I think speaks volumes in terms of being able to move past trauma. Because like Hugh was dealing with trauma the same way Picard is, except he's gone into like complete immersion therapy. Like he's like, I don't want to be here, but I have to be here because no one else understands what X-Borg are except for me, you, and Seven of Nine.
Hugh is like the most together person on this show. Aide, what do you think?
I'm monopolizing the conversation.
No, it's fine. Let's go for it. It's all good. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I'm surprised at actually how much Picard actually seemed to be reflecting on his experiences with the Borg after, because obviously it was always part of that thing. It was always his thing. And funny enough, writing Picard up for the role-playing game, that was one of his like his little things on there about his experience with the Borg. So it was always something that was always kind of key to his character after that season.
Go but back and tell me more about what you just said, Aide. When you were writing up Picard, you wanted to make a mention of his Borg experience on his character?
Yes, yeah, they do have, each character has like four different kind of traits that basically define that character. Okay. And in the role-playing game, they change over time and you can switch stuff in, switch stuff out, whatever. What's kind of important to that character at that point in time? And one of them is the experience with the Borg. So it's definitely a thing. But yeah, this one seems the best scene in it, in my opinion, for the Borg thing was when the holographic screen showed Locutus on the screen.
Wasn't that great?
That was so good. Yeah.
When they put the image up there and then they shift the camera just a little bit so that it's basically projecting Locutus on top of Picard's face.
Yeah.
And it was
and the acting that moment where Picard touches his head where the implant is.
Yes, yeah.
Like,
great.
Like, that's what sold it to me, because at that point, like prior to that point, I was like, "Oh, this is fan service. Like this is like you can't get Patrick Stewart in the chair for 6 hours. So this is as close as you're gonna get." But once he put his hand on his face, and it was a shaking hand, like it wasn't steady. Mm. Like once that happened, I was like, "Okay, you just sold me on the fan service, and you gave me an acting moment."
What I saw there was physical memory. Like he was looking at it and thinking, I can feel the metal, like in my head. And I thought he did a great job of selling that moment.
So the other thing about is when he was on the board, on the actual artifact as well, it's when the two X-Borg kind of grab hold of him and said, oh yeah, they're trying to make you so you don't fall.
Yeah.
Definitely one of those Borg woke up in those alcoves, didn't they? And recognized Locutus. I swear, there's a shot where Borg wakes up, and then when he's leaving, someone says, "Oh, Locutus," and he turns around. Whether it's the same guy, or whether or not it's just the Borg racial memory kind of thing going on, and everything, I don't know. But I swear, if there's not some kind of Borg rampage going on at some point in that cube, I'll be very surprised.
I thought it was delightful. I mean, we didn't get a chance to explore it, but he and Hugh are running at the end of the episode, and some random Borg in the hallway just says, "Locutus," like, "Hey, I know that guy." Yeah.
Very cool.
Let's get back to Stardust City Rise. Both these episodes are giant meals, and we're more at like a buffet table right now, going, what are we going to pick?
There's so much. I mean, the first thing that a lot of fans, I think, saw about Stardust City Rise, and part of this is because of the way the show was advertised and marketed, is that it was the comedy dress-up episode, right, where we're all in funny costumes. But as we all remember, there's a lot of those episodes in Star Trek. Like, we can all remember Next Gen episodes and original series episodes where everybody dressed up as like Robin Hood and his Merry Men, or dressed up in gangster outfits or something ridiculous like that. I mean, this is a long-standing Star Trek tradition to dress up in funny outfits.
Yeah, I loved Pirate Picard. I think I texted you, Jason.
Yeah.
Pirate Picard was best Picard.
Yeah.
because Patrick Stewart has been known to do the opening monologue in his French accented voice.
Okay.
And it kills him. Like physically, when he's doing it, like afterwards, he has to drink water and like calm his vocal cords. So like while he's doing this, I'm like, oh my God, this guy is in so much pain.
He didn't have too many lines as Pirate Picard.
He didn't have too many lines, but they were wonderfully done lines.
Yeah, he was funny. But in many ways, that's kind of a shell game with this episode, because it pretends to be the comedy episode, but it's really extremely heavy by the end. Like, I honestly felt this was the Stardust City Rag was the most kind of depressing of all of the episodes so far, partly because I really wanted to like Jurati, right? And so, and when she was revealed, when she kills Maddox at the end, and the actress is so great because she totally sold the reluctant murder, you know, like, and she says this enigmatic phrase, like, if you had seen what I seen. So for a while, we wondered if maybe she was like, how are the Romulans or whoever it is controlling her or manipulating her? We had a number of possible strategies. We talked about a mind meld. I think this might have been AIDS idea. But one of us talked about a mind meld that maybe, because if O is a Vulcan, she could have planted a hypnotic suggestion inside of Jurati. We were always suspicious of her because she shows up at the last minute and shoots a Romulan, which seemed totally out of character for her. And the Romulan would have totally kicked her ass. So why did she? But when you think of the Tal Shiar as gladly just killing off their own men so that they could set up Jurati as the plant, it made sense. I, of course, was innocent and naive from the beginning. I always thought she was perfectly normal. It wasn't until you two came up and realized that she's probably a plant. And you are proven right, of course.
I didn't want to like it. Like, I didn't want Jurati. I wanted Jurati to go against that sort of grain.
But it seems like Commodore O showed her something that convinced her she had to kill Maddox and Soji.
Yeah, because I don't think we saw a little flashback to her and Maddox, and obviously working at Daystrom. I don't think she can be a Romulan agent that far back. I think at least she has to be something recent. I can't believe it's like, hey, we planted you in the Daystrom all this time, just in case robots decide to take over. Yeah.
And Admiral O, we still haven't resolved for sure if she is either a Romulan, a Vulcan from the Mirror Universe, or just a Vulcan who likes wearing shades. But it's probably not the latter because of the interview with Shaban. Right? So where he says, yes, you're right. Vulcans don't need sunglasses. So why would we do that? So, but if she didn't mind meld, then that means she doesn't need to be a Vulcan and the Romulan thing holds up. So I think the weight of the evidence is that Commodore O is a Romulan and constructed or has, maybe just as a really good liar and convinced Jurati that she had to do this. Jim, you said that you saw this coming a mile away.
Well, I did. Like, actually, like, my wife has been suspicious of him whole, like, since day one. And I've been like, no, I want her to be the doe-eyed one.
Yeah.
And then I realized sitting, like, watching the, like, what's the chocolate chip? Like, we have to talk about the chocolate chips.
Okay.
Because I think another concept in the main plot is this idea of imperfection being better than perfection. Right? Yes.
So,
and that's sort of Data's whole struggle, right? Like, he can do things that a normal human being can't. He can, you know, bend titanium in his bare hands. He can process all these things, but he can't understand a joke.
The scene that you're talking about is a flashback that Jurati watches in her bedroom privately. And it's where we find out that she and Maddox were romantically involved. And Maddox has used a replicator to create all of the ingredients for chocolate chip cookies so that he can bake the cookies himself. And this is an obvious metaphor for Soji and Daj. And Jurati is like, why didn't you just replicate the cookies? He's like, well, because I don't like replicator cookies, right?
Well, because replicator cookies would give you, like, a pre-programmed, you have 9 chips. If you had actual chocolate chip cookies made by someone, you get the cookie with too many chocolate chips, you get the cookie with not enough chocolate chips, and you get the cookie that's just right somewhere in the middle of the batch, right? And that's sort of like what Maddox is trying to go for when he says that they are perfectly imperfect.
Yes.
At the end of the episode.
Yes. He's talking about Soji when he says
that. He's talking about Soji and he's talking about Daj. Like, I wish you would have seen them. They're perfectly imperfect.
Yeah.
And that's sort of like that whole concept of perfection versus imperfection.
Yeah.
And I think it echoes Picard's breaking faith with the Federation. Because it's the perfect being the enemy of the good, right? That we talked about in episode 4.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, and you know, this is an old theme. It goes back to our original series. The idea that, yes, humans are not as good as we could be, but our imperfections are what make us human, mm-hmm. right? And when Kirk is at the funeral for Spock at the end of Star Trek II, and he says he was the most human person I've ever known, and he says it while his voice is cracking, right? He means he was perfect in his imperfections, right?
Yeah. Or to bring it back to Next Generation, when Picard tells Q, "What a piece of work is man," what Shakespeare says in irony, I say with conviction. And he gives that whole speech. Like, that is like core fundamental Star Trek, that yes, you are an imperfect being, and that is okay, because that should be celebrated and accepted, and that's part of who you are.
And I think I like your point about bringing it back to that question of the perfect being the enemy of the good. Mm-hmm. Picard was insisting on perfection when he quit the Federation.
And it's very much writ large in the book.
Oh, is it? Yeah.
Which I'm only 100 pages in, but Girardi has shown up, and she's totally a Maddox fangirl. People laying it on thick.
Yeah. The cool thing about, because Alison Pill is the actress who plays Girardi.
Okay.
And spoilers for anybody that hasn't seen American Horror Story from 2017.
Okay.
She does the same thing in that. She's one of the betrayers in it. So, but the thing in that series, she does it because she wants to do it. In this series, you definitely get the idea. This is very reluctant. This is not something she's relishing in. She's not the evil, manipulative bad guy. Just go, ha ha, I have you now, and pulls this, you know, James Bond style. This is something that's this is where this is quite an interesting twist for this character, rather than just being another pawn in the, you know, in the kind of the game of chess.
Yeah, there's this brilliant little moment when they're all waiting to try to get onto the Borg cube, and they realize that only Picard can go. And she says, "Oh, we can't go." And they're like, "Well, I'm sorry to disappoint you." And she's like, "I'm not disappointed. I'm relieved. Because if she went to the cube and saw Soji, she'd have to kill her." Right? I remember back in one of our early episodes, Jim and Aide, you guys were both talking about the Narek Soji romance. And what you didn't want to see was Narek redeemed. Right?
Like, you didn't want to see Narek is phased down. That's still on the table.
Say that again?
Narek is phased down, that is still on the table. That can still happen. Narratively speaking, the writers of the show could try to give us a redemption of Narek.
They could. They could.
Even after he exposes Hull to the radiation, very similar in the scene of Star Trek Nemesis when Shinzon kills off the Senate.
Oh, is that what that is?
It's not the same gas. Like, this gas is red. That gas was green. But the idea of it coming in a small package and being dispersed into the air was very evocative of it, at least.
This is clearly how Romulans like to kill people. Yeah. You're right. I mean, they could still do it. But I find that the Narek's arc and Girardi's arc are interestingly different, in the sense that if Narek is redeemed, we are going to hate it because he's a really evil bastard. But if Girardi is given a path to redemption, it might not be so terrible. Like, she'd have to, you know, it has to be honest. But I'm much more sympathetic to Girardi getting a second chance after this is all over. I don't know.
The other thing is, we don't really know what her mission is. Because when they mentioned about getting onto the Borg cube, she says about, I can just say I'm there for whatever reason. They say, oh, that won't work. So she actively wants to go there for a reason. So, whether it is purely assassination or just curiosity or what.
I don't think she wants to go there. I think she's saying that because she feels she has to.
Yeah, yeah.
For her mission. Like, this is what Commodore O told her. Commodore O was like, okay, you're going to go to the Borg cube. You're going to claim that you're a scientist and you need to go onto the Borg cube that way. And when she tries to give that plan, Picard's like, immediately, nope, that won't work. We can't do that. And she's like, inwardly, her thought balloon is, thank God. I don't have to do it.
Well, the other thing is like, this is a woman who's lived her life in a post best of both worlds world, right?
Yes.
Like, she was probably 10 or so when those episodes happened.
Okay.
Who in the right mind living with that, having seen 39 starships blown up full of people, who would want to visit a bold cube?
Right.
That takes a special type of individual who wants to do that. And Jurati's like, oh, that's a relief. Like, I don't have to do this awful thing.
Okay, so you don't think it's related to her mission. You think she just want to go on a bold cube.
I think it had more to do with, like, the bold or scary bastards.
Yeah.
I don't want to deal with that.
Oh, because when do we actually learn that Soji's actually on the cube? It's not... I don't think O knows she's on the cube. I think O literally plants her there to just follow Picard around and hopefully find Maddox.
That's true.
I don't think it's like just follow Maddox and then go to the cube. But they don't know about it then. So she's tagging along and kind of making it up as she goes along, effectively.
Yeah,
so,
she only had missions up to Maddox, right?
Yeah, I would assume so, yeah. Yeah.
So let's get back to Seven. Because we haven't really talked about her story arc at all. It's suggested pretty strongly that she had a relationship with Bajazel, which will no doubt give us fan fiction for a decade.
Let's temple that a little bit.
Okay.
By saying that you can have queer readings of Seven in the context of Star Trek Voyager. Like, it's not outside of the realm of possibility.
You're right, and I have seen that, but unpack it for us, for the people
So Janeway has a special program where she occasionally meets Leonardo da Vinci, and she goes there to think on her problems. And at one point, Seven activates that program without Janeway's permission. And when Janeway goes in there, they have this really sort of intimate conversation.
Okay.
Well, it's not intimated within the text of the show, but the subtext of what the actors play. Like, she talks about having fantasies and playing out fantasies in this room. This room that's Janeway's. So you can have that reading of Seven of Nine as a bisexual character, because they do give her male, like, overtly male romances with Chakotay near the end.
Okay.
And also, there is another scene where the doctor inside Seven of Nine's implants, it just sounds awful to say.
Seven of Nine's implants
are putting on a female character. Like, and the female character is the female crewman is reciprocating and is very much into it. But the caveat is, you know, that it's the doctor inside Seven's body, which is a whole nother weird thing.
Okay. Interesting.
So you can have queer readings of Seven beyond this one episode.
So in other words, this episode is not establishing that she's bisexual. It's in many ways advancing that.
Yeah, I wish the episode would have done more to actually actually named it that.
Yeah.
Like, that's one of my critiques of the episode, was we kind of play up the fact that she's the only one that knows Seven's real name. So at some point after Voyager and before, you know, she kills Icheb and she finds out it is Bajazel, she accepts her name as Annika, which only a few people on Voyager even knew that was her name.
Right.
I think the doctor knew it, and I think Janeway knew it. And I think that was it. I could be mistaken. My Voyager knowledge isn't all that great. So at some point, she accepts that because she's the only one, and there was an intimacy between the two actresses every time she calls her Annika. And you can see sort of the portrayal in Seven of Nine's expression going, that name sort of dead to me. Like, she's kind of dead-naming her in this moment.
Interesting.
But I wish the show would have actually just had – made it more oval as opposed to playing with subtext.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a big challenge with LGBTQ relationships in television, that often the studio kind of makes a head fake towards it without making it explicit. And it becomes very easy to not look at, to ignore, or explain it as something else if that makes you uncomfortable.
Yeah. The irony being, as well, is that we've got a potential Romulan brother and sister relationship going on. That's fine. but possibly, we don't want to go too far. It just seems to be a bit crazy. We go full Game of Thrones. We don't mind doing that.
Oh, yeah, but the Romulans are evil, so it's okay.
That's it, yeah. But it's just a weird cutoff point, yeah.
That's another problem I have with Trek and exploring sexual issues is, first off, Star Trek owes a giant debt to the female fans in the 70s that read into Kirk Spock.
That's right.
saw at the convention circuit was their enthusiasm for that relationship on screen. So much so that Gene Roddenberry had to go out of his way in the novelization of the motion picture to say, no homo. Like, not happening, you're brother. Like, he spends pages on it
really?
To establish that this is not a thing.
That's funny.
So the creator of the show is having to refute it in the novelization of his first movie.
That's funny.
The other aspect is the male universe, it's okay to be bisexual.
Right, yeah.
So it's okay to be bisexual if you're a bad guy.
Yeah, that's not Star Trek. That's a lot of genre fiction, right? The same thing happens to, like, when Willow in Buffy first finds out that she's gay when she sees evil Willow.
Mm-hmm.
Says, I think I'm kind of gay, right? Like, so, yeah.
And then, you know, the thing that pushes Hull into being a villain in that season is that whole gay partner dies.
Yes, that's right.
Like, she's mortal, and then Willow just becomes evil for the whole sixth season.
Yeah, yeah. So...
Impromptu Buffy talk.
Yeah. Hey, these shows all feed on each other, right? But Buffy's a wonderful show. So let's touch on that moment that Seven and Jean-Luc have on the transporter when they're sharing their thoughts about being recovering Borg. What's the name that Hugh gives them? Enbys?
Xbys.
Xbys. X-Borg. When she asks him if he has his humanity, did he recover? Did he get his humanity back? To which he says yes, but did you get all of it? And of course, he says no, and she admits that she also is the same way, but she's fighting to reclaim it, right? She's trying to just sort of be the best imperfect human that she can be every day for the rest of her life. And then she immediately transports down the planet and murders Bajazel, which is perhaps not the most, I mean, and I think, Jim, you noted this, it's a very, revenge is a very human thing, mm-hmm. right? But like, it's a
the Borg
very-
do that. The Borg themselves, there was no point to doing that action, so the Borg would not pursue it. Like, they don't pursue revenge.
Yeah.
They assimilate, they consume.
Yeah.
But they don't go out of the way to be like, Picard defeated us again. We're going to specifically send this strike team to go after just him. Like, they don't do that. Like, right. That was a very human action to do.
We would think of it as an immoral or unethical act. It's a bad thing, but that bad thing is part of her being human. Right? Anyway.
Yeah, and I know some people don't like the treatment of Seven in this episode.
Okay.
And I get the impression is they reckon she's acting it out of character because of her kind of like quest for vengeance and this kind of stuff. No. But we don't know what's happened in the last 14 years. We've got some reason for it, but we haven't obviously done what happened since she left Voyager. But the other thing being is, of course, 709 was never actually a Starfleet officer, technically speaking. So she hasn't got like that, you know, years of training. She was a Borg, you know, and they went around assimilating, you know, people left, right, and center. So,
and she's been a member of the Fenris Rangers for we don't know how long. And the Rangers appear to be, I mean, Picard calls them vigilantes, and she's like, okay, fine, you want to call me a vigilante, that's fine. But the point is, you know, he's like, well, you're taking the law into your own hands. And she's like, what law? There is no law out here. And
she's so definitely going full on Punisher in this episode.
I saw it less as the Punisher and more like a kind of neighborhood watch organization, right? Like the Fenris Rangers are a group of people with the resources to try to create law and order in this wild, untamed space. And they don't have any authority, but they're trying to do the best they can under very difficult situations, you know? But the Fenris Rangers probably are in the books. We probably learn more about them in the novel.
My reading, like, again, I'm only 100 pages in.
Yeah.
I think the Fenris Rangers are a outcome. My understanding of reading the interviews is it's an outcome of the supernova and the lack of evacuation. They are a body that's created because Starfleet failed.
Okay.
Right? Like, I think, and this from my understanding, this book is only going to cover that failure. I don't, like, maybe subsequent novels will explore that area.
Maybe they're more like the Sons of Batman from Dark Knight Returns. The SOB. Yeah.
Well, I can't believe there won't be a 7 or 9 Famous Ranger novel at some point. That's
definitely. That just seems like print money.
The world building of this series I continue to really love. Just like how I loved the Romulan warrior nuns, there are people right now making characters who are Fenris Rangers, right? And they can't wait to play those Fenris Ranger characters. And I love that. I love putting these hooks for players to latch on.
I actually logged into RPGNet after we did the last talk. Yeah. And there are several people talking about this episode and saying exactly that. That's the next character I'm playing. That's the next character I'm playing. So you are correct, yes. Yeah.
Well, it reminds me a little bit of the Maquis in the sense that we kind of the Maquis are like Starfleet but shady. Right?
Yeah.
And the Fenris Rangers are kind of like that. Like
they weren't shady. Like
okay.
So the Maquis, yes, they're portrayed as shady in Next Generation. But the Maquis are responding to the fact that planets were given to Cardassian space.
Yeah.
In a treaty. So they had a justified, like, their home is, like, one day they wake up and they're all the Federation, and the next day they are answering to a Cardassian god or
like. I don't think they're any more shady. I think the Fenris Rangers are also, like, have pretty firm moral and ethical grounding, in my opinion. They're portrayed as they're shady because of that fantastic DS9 episode where Riker's transporter clone comes back, which maybe my favorite episode of DS9 ever.
It is good.
It is a good one. It is good. I don't know if it's the best one, but
well,
it's
really good. I love it because if you remember, so we have to go back into the Wayback Machine here, but this is in, I believe, the third season of TS9 of Next Generation.
On Next Generation season 6. It's late in the show.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, it's late.
Later than I thought. Well, anyway, where Riker, they go to a planet where Riker had once visited, and we find out that in a transporter accident, a duplicate Riker was created who never stopped loving Deanna Troi and shaved his beard and or never grew it out. And Frakes gets to play both of these characters. And one of them is still operation. The other guy is still operations. He's not command. And there was I remember when I first watched that episode, and I was talking to some Star Trek fans who were, and one of them was an employee of my bookstore at the time. And we wanted the original Riker to leave the show, and the replacement Riker to stay, like to replace him on the show, which was something we thought maybe might have been. In the at least talked about in the writer's room, but that didn't happen. So when I got to see that plot hook come back, that's why I happen to love that episode. But anyway,
it's a good episode. Don't get me wrong. I love the cheese factor. It's totally Star Trek cheese factor when he just rips off his beard.
and it's fake Will. What was the name that he calls himself? It's not Will.
It's Thomas.
Thomas, that's his middle name, Thomas. Anyway, but we got off track.
Fenris Rangers.
Seven has clearly changed since we saw her on Voyager. She's more human. She's wearing regular clothes. Her hair's grown out. All of that seems to me to be indicating that she is less Borg, more human in her personality and life. She's talking normal.
Yes.
Yes. That's true.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so have we missed anything on Stardust City Rag?
Let's talk about the opening.
The opening.
The cold opening.
Yeah, sure. You mean when 7 of 9 is rescuing?
Yeah. Well, even before 7 shows up, when each app is being dissected on the table.
Yeah. And when I saw that trailer, when that opened, that was pretty grotesque. Like, they were pulling this person's eyeball out of his socket. Well, and there was a lot of blood, and I thought it was pretty gory. Aide, what did you think?
Yeah, it was actually quite surprising. And I didn't know what was going on originally. I thought, Borg. Yeah, that's interesting. The I don't know if Jim's going to go on this as well, but the interesting thing about the Borg thing is who are they selling the parts to? Who are these? Who is buying these parts up? And
parts of Borg parts.
Yeah, and the obviously,
yeah,
all those bits that they're ripping off of the Borg on the cube. Are they selling them out the back in a van somewhere to the people that buy them as well? It's just like it seems to be making them a lot of money. Maybe that's how they fund it or something. It just seems to be a thing. But yeah, interesting. Yeah.
Jim,
My thought was so there was a giant discussion as to whether or not it was Star Trek, or whether or not it was appropriate.
Well, this is like the swearing and the cigarettes, right?
Yeah, like the gratuitous nature of it. And my thought was, I didn't think it was graphic enough. Because what we're dealing with essentially is the dehumanization of an individual.
Yes, he's an object.
Yeah, he's totally an object. He is being sold in pulse. And anytime we've dealt with the dehumanization of individuals in our society, it is a very cruel, very vindictive, very gratuitous and uncomfortable thing. So I think making the audience uncomfortable, like, I don't think Star Trek's necessarily supposed to be comfort food. And I think Picard is making a point of saying, this is not comfort food. This is, we're going to be talking about people in much the same way that's happening now with people being in cages on our border. I mean, that's a very dehumanizing thing.
So we're going to eat your vegetables and like it.
Yeah, for me, the gratuitous nature of the scene, because I'm very uncomfortable when anything happens to the eye.
Yeah.
Like for me, it's squeamish. I have to look away. I get very upset. That's just like one of my peccadilloes. For me, the fact that I wasn't comfortable justified Seven of Nine. Like I understood where she was coming from as a character because it's like that could have been her.
Yeah.
And that was someone she cares about. That was like the closest, like she says, like that was the closest thing I have to Kent.
Okay, so for people that don't know, can you remind us where Icheb comes from and his story arc? Because he appears in multiple Voyager episodes.
Yeah, he's part of this group called the Borg Kids or the Borg Children or something like that. He's like the leader. There's like four or five of them. He's the one who gets the most screen time because he's the oldest, so they can do stuff with him. And they find him on a planet that's there's some Borg wreckage. They find him on this planet, and he's just like it is putting Seven of Nine like mother figure, right? Like she starts off as the sex symbol on the show, and now it's moving her to a more human role of not just sex symbol but mom.
Is this later in Voyager's?
Yeah, this is around still season six, I think. Again, my Voyager knowledge isn't as well versed as other tracks, but this is around season six or so that these kids become a factor in the show.
Well,
and they recast him in the show because at one point Voyager becomes a generational ship, and we see Icheb in like command red. Yeah. So like his pathway to becoming the better Wesley was established in Voyager. So him showing up in a Starfleet uniform wasn't surprising.
Yeah, the cool thing being is, last podcast we did, we actually said, were they going to show up? And they actually used it to give for Seven of Nine motivation, which is really cool. But yeah, the cool thing about him being in a Starfleet uniform and Seven of Nine, when she rescues him, not being in a Starfleet uniform, seems to suggest that Seven of Nine never joined Starfleet, but he did.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
It's interesting also, the idea that making Seven a sort of maternal figure also gives her some interesting parallels to the Borg Queen, right? So that she can be like a good Borg maternal figure instead of the evil Borg maternal figure, the evil stepmother.
Evil stepmother. I was just going to make that clear. Yeah.
So, all right.
I found Easter eggs in that episode. There was like a shout out to those two shout outs to Quark from DS9. Mr. Mott has a barber shop now on FreeCloud. I sort of hope that, like, I want them to establish that FreeCloud is Quark's moon that he always finally got. Like, that's my headcanon.
That would be cool, yeah.
Now, wait a minute. Go back a second here. Now, who has a barber shop?
Okay, Mr. Mott, the Bolian hairdresser that Picard goes to.
Next Generation, yeah.
Next Generation. I wish I would have bought it. I actually have a little cartoon sketch of Worf and Mr. Mott in the in the bobble trail. It's at the office. I don't have it with me here. So
I had forgotten about the Bolian hairdresser, but now it is coming back to me. I remember him now. And yeah, there were some drops, some name drops of Quark. I love the idea that Free Cloud is Quark's moon. That would be pretty great.
Yeah, because Quark is obsessed with the moon because his uncle has a moon. He's like, I have a moon. So if Free Cloud winds up being like the fact that it's Vegas, it's because it's Quark's little moon, I'll be so happy.
Yeah.
Like, you know what? He made it.
We have not talked about Raffi's mission and her confrontation with her son about any of this. I thought they did a pretty good job of keeping the nature of Raffi's quest a secret. I had no idea what it was about until she got there. I actually was pretty cynical about it. I thought it was going to be some terrible, like, drug-related plot line, you know, where she needs to, like, you know, get high forever or something terrible like that. But instead, it was a very touching family reunion moment. I loved how they telegraphed pretty clearly to the audience immediately that her son still resented her, but she doesn't pick up on it immediately. And so there's the scene goes for a minute or so where she keeps thinking that she could still make this work, and we realize that it's hopeless, which I thought was very poignant and sad. Apparently, the cause of this all was that she got kind of obsessed with her focus on the Romulan involvement in the synthetic attack.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you guys got from this as well?
Well, if we read into the Maul's attack as Starfleet's 9/11,
yeah,
I think the show is obviously doing that. The concept of the Council of Eight or the involvement of the Tal Shiar or the the Zat Vash in it becomes the Truthful movement, right? It becomes right. Sort of the conspiracy theories around 9/11 that we've all had to live with for the last 19 years.
But in this show, it's setting up the Truther as being correct.
And Star Trek's had a problem with that in the past because in Into Darkness, one of the main writers, Robert Olsey, not Alex Kurtzman, one of the main writers is a Truther himself. So he kept injecting a whole bunch of Trutherism conspiracy theories into the script. So when you start watching Into Darkness through a Truther lens, it becomes a little bit more coherent in a strange kind of way.
More coherent.
The first time we've seen this in Trek.
That's interesting. So she was sort of this conspiracy theorist, and her husband and son were alienated by it.
Mm-hmm.
And she left, and they've gone their own way, apparently. And of course the kicker is when he introduces his Romulan wife, right? Raffi's gonna be a grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
She's gonna have a half Romulan granddaughter. But she doesn't seem angry or resentful of the daughter. Like, I don't think she hates Romulans.
No.
Right?
Yeah, no, it doesn't seem to be a dwarf elf thing, like in Lord of the Rings. It does seem, yeah, it definitely seems to be just because she wants to be proved right that she hasn't gone insane and all those things she was saying was true. It could have been anybody, but she doesn't hold every single individual responsible for it.
Yeah.
And to fall back on the novel again, like Raffi is a Romulan intelligence agent.
Okay.
So Raffi has to deal with all the weird conspiracy theories that Romulans come up with on everything. So she's trying to always outthink them. So that may either be a character flaw or it may be that there is actually a plot.
There might be kind of an abyss gazes also into you kind of thing going on here, where she
it could be that, yes.
She has been messing with the Romulans so long that she can't stop thinking like one.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is a good transition into the second half of the second episode that we wanted to talk about, the Impossible Box, when Raffi is on the ship, but she's basically intoxicated and useless. But they say, well, we need you to do this, so they bring her up. And she manages to get these diplomatic credentials for Picard to get onto the cube, basically by saying, look, we're already here. He's going to go on there anyway. It's going to be a huge diplomatic incident unless you provide him some cover. Mm-hmm. And the admiral or whoever she's talking to gives them that credentials, but then says, never call me again. Like, this is it.
Yeah, and also the interesting thing about that is they mentioned that it's a former neutral zone. So we do no longer have a neutral zone established. So there's no transitional kind of border between Romulan space. So it'd be really interesting to see exactly what is left of Romulan space. Obviously, we've got these little enclaves of survivors, but have they actually got something that can enforce it? It's...
You know what? There was another comment that really made me wonder, because Hugh is talking to Picard. You know, Jim knows exactly what I'm going to say.
I mean, the moment they said that line, I'm like, here it comes. I got to make a note of this.
Because Hugh says we still have a queen, only now she's a Romulan. So that means that whoever is leading the Romulans is female.
Right.
So it's got to be Sela, right?
You would have thought.
I think you might be right on this. Like, if we're going to like revisit all of Picard's sins, like Tasha Yar dying is one of the big ones, right?
I mean, I don't think we'll get it this season. I think we'll be setting it up, but we have two more seasons of this show, right? It can't all be Picard and Soji on the run for three seasons.
No.
Yeah.
I think once this macro plot is resolved in some fashion, I think the idea of Picard being an advocate for Borg is really interesting.
Yes.
Because that gets to the idea of, can you be a part of a system and not be evil?
Yeah.
Right? Like the Borg themselves, like individually, they're all victims. But the collective as a whole is an evil.
Yes.
Like, can you contribute to a society? And that's something that we as Americans, we as people living in Western civilization are struggling with right now is, can we be part of these systems and still consider ourselves good people?
And
as individuals.
When there was a clear development in Picard this episode, because he starts off by saying they're bored. They can't convert. They can't become better. They can't change. They're bored. But then he knew that was wrong. Like, that was his – he knew himself that was wrong, but that was his own fears and his own anxiety talking. And so then when he's with Hugh and he's seeing the recovering Borg, and he has to acknowledge, like, they can't – they're victims. They can change. They have to be unplugged from the collective.
Mm-hmm.
They need help. They need psychological and physical help. They need medical care. But they can rejoin society and they can live happy and fulfilling lives. Look at Hugh. Hugh's totally together, in a mental sense. And that's when Hugh sort of slides that little thing in. He's like, yeah, like because Picard came and he's like, okay, I need to find Soji. Can you find Soji for me? But the next time we see them, they're not looking for Soji. They're in the recuperation area. And we find out that Hugh did this on purpose. This is what I love about this episode, because Hugh's got an agenda, and that's good writing. When the minor characters have an agenda and they're like, okay, what does Hugh want? How can we show what Hugh's trying to get out of all this? And Hugh shows Picard these people that are recovering. And he's like, you know, if there was a spokesman for the Borg, and if that spokesman was Jean-Luc Picard, boy, that'd be something, he said, right? Like, and I'm like, oh, there it is. Like, yeah. How can Picard not take that bait, right? Like, that's he was brilliant. It was really well done.
If they kill him off next episode, I'm going to be angry.
Oh, they better.
Because it's obvious from the teaser that he's captured by the evil twins or the evil siblings.
Oh, I didn't watch the teaser actually, so I.
Oh yeah, he's thrown on the floor and there's like a knife drawn on him or something. No, like a phaser pointed at him. I'm like, if you kill off Hugh, I am gonna be so angry, show.
Yeah. A, what about you? What'd you think about the Impossible Box?
Yeah, it was weird. Again, like I said to you before, we are now six episodes in. We've got 10 episodes. I'm still utterly bewildered how we're going to fit the entire story into this 10 episode.
Yeah,
it's interesting, but I liked it.
it's moving fast now.
Yes, they definitely. Yeah, that's the thing. I was saying to my friend the other day about I can watch this, and I'm going, crikey, was that, is that it? Is that finished now? It seems to such 45 minutes just seems to click along at no time and so whatsoever. Obviously, on Amazon Prime, there's no ads either, so you don't get even ad breaks. You just get the phases and transitions. So,
have either of you ever read the Nine Princes in Amber series by Roger Zelazny?
No, you've mentioned it to me in private.
I know of it, but yeah.
All right, so this is a wonderful fantasy, science fantasy story series. Originally 5 books, and then there were 5 sequels, which are not as good, and a couple of short stories. But there is this thing in the Amber series called The Pattern. And in the beginning of the first book, our protagonist, whose name is Corwin, has amnesia. He does not remember who he is or anything from his past. And what he does not know is that he's this sort of demigod-like figure. And there's this thing on the ground in this castle called the Pattern. And to regain his memory, Corwin walks this pattern. And it's this sort of big design on the floor. And as he walks, these sparks come up from the floor. And the longer he walks, the harder it becomes. And the sparks rise higher and higher and higher. And there are these sort of moments along the pattern. We don't get the whole thing described to us, but it has like, okay, this is the grand curve. And here's like the first gate or whatever it's called, you know. And then as he walks, his memory comes back to him. And then when he gets to the middle of the pattern, he can use it to teleport anywhere in the galaxy. And it really reminded me of this episode of Soji walking the pattern to regain her memory. And then at the end of the episode, in a different room, albeit, going through a portal that teleports her across the galaxy. And I would very be curious to know if Michael Chabon was homaging or had read or was riffing on Amber and the Pattern. Mm-hmm. But that is neither here nor there.
Yes, go.
No, go,
Aid. The only thing I was going to say about that scene in the room.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, before that, we got the idea she was scanning all of her stuff and effectively carbon dating all of her stuff, and it was going for 3 years, and that was all she had, and that was it. So we know now that they've been in creation for 3 years.
We don't think we had a firm date.
Yeah. I don't think we had a firm date then. All we knew is it was sometime between 14 years and today. That was it.
Yeah.
The strange thing I thought was funny is, obviously, when she's kind of got the false memories implanted to her, and you see her as a younger girl and she can't see what's going on, I actually thought they were going to kind of flash back to her adult self, kind of experience those memories as well. Because technically speaking, she never was that younger girl.
That's right.
So it's like she's only ever been as she is now.
That's interesting.
Just as an aside, just thought it was just like, okay, that was weird. Because again, the object, we don't know that lab, that room.
Yes, with the orchids.
And the orchids and stuff.
Yeah.
We don't even know if that really exists, because obviously the idea that we see, like the puppet version of her on the table, theoretically that's just an analogy. That is not actually a physical thing that the guy's built. So that room may not actually even exist. It could just be a purely fictitious memory.
It's her subconscious trying to tell her that she...
I'd be interested to see what that room actually is, if it does show up. And obviously the idea that he turns around and he can never see his face seems to suggest, well, who is that guy then?
And Jim, you had a suggestion for why we can't see his face.
I do.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. There's a couple of things I want to unpack with this scene. So this is, whereas the Bacall Pack attack and the wonderful minute 96 seconds of have you regained your humanity, all of it, no. Those, well, for me, the understanding, this is a show about trauma and recognizing when something happens to you, as opposed to you being an agent and having agency of your own life.
Okay.
This scene with Soji is interesting in that we can't see Hofamo's face. Yeah. I don't think it's Maddox.
Yeah.
I think it might be soon. So Maddox says right before he dies, Soon and I did the work.
That's
it together. Now my thinking with that line is we can read it metaphorically, like he was taking Soon's work and continuing with it, or we can read it literally, because we know that in the Star Trek universe, you can clone someone in 16 hours courtesy of Deep Space Nine.
Now, is Soon dead? What's Soon?
Soon died. Soon is killed by Lore. In the Star Trek fourth season episode called Brothers, Lore, there was like a Soon family reunion where he recalls back Data. He produces the emotion chip. Lore steals the emotion chip and kills Soon. We also know that a predecessor of Soon's from Enterprise was a geneticist. Mm-hmm. So there was a history of being involved in genetics work. And the idea that Soji is the most perfect, Soji and Daj are the most perfect because it blends technology and biology together so seamlessly that they don't even know themselves. Like it's that Deckel syndrome. It's Blade Runner, right?
Yes, exactly.
They're so close to the real McCoy, they'd have no idea because they've been given all these memories. And I think that's to your point. I think that's why she doesn't experience him as an adult, because we all have those memories of imperfectness, you know, from our childhood. Well, there was something that was scary to us, right? And if Soji and Dodge didn't have that, it would be kind of weird. Right? Like, we all can recall a time when we were little kids and our parents were mad at us and we were scared, right? Like, that's a natural human sort of human experience moment. And so I think that this is a creation, it's a fabrication. I'm also interested to note that Soon built Data to have dreams, right? Those are the Next Generation episode Phantasms,
yes,
where Data's dreaming. But in the episode Phantasms, all the dream imagery is Brian Braga's strangeness. Like, it's three Walkmen walking on a plasma coil. It's Data has a cell phone in his chest. Like, I don't know why they had to be so literal. Like, Narek bucks out. Like, the fact that he doesn't have to interpret, like, meet Sigmund Freud in the holodeck to explain where this planet is, and he's just like, oh, it's two moons and a lightning storm. Like, these Romulans really lucked out that the whoever designed the dream program so that they can reconcile their two halves was so literal.
Yeah, interesting.
And the end of that scene where he releases the gas, red gas. He mentions radiation. He said the guy's about to open the door, he says no to radiation. I swear that's what he says.
Yeah,
so we still don't know quite exactly what Soji's makeup is. Is she Data in just a slightly less more organic looking Data? Is she human biology with a positronic implant kind of thing going on or whatever? Because you get the idea, if it's radiation, this is probably, she's more human with enhancements than Data was.
Mm-hmm.
See, I don't think she's like an android as such. I don't think you're going to be like popping her head cap open like Data used to do all the while. And it seems to be she's a physical being as human, but with enhancements. But when she punches through the floor as well, that reminds me of when Data did the thing in some of the episodes where he switches the isolinear chips out of the computers. That's brilliant. Cool.
Well, then she was doing it very quickly, right?
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't just she was punching the floor. She's doing it at a speed that no one should be moving.
No, that's right. Yeah.
And then she drops down, right? So Soji drops down through the floor, and finally we get the Picard meeting.
Yes.
And, you know, klaxons are going off and Romulans are running down the hallways and everything's gone to hell. And Picard says, trust me.
Yeah, you have to trust me, yeah.
And this Soji, this android, this synthetic life, hasn't had the mother program activated.
Yes.
So remember in the first episode, we were like, why is there a glitch with the mom program? That's because the mom program is the sleep program, right?
Yeah.
It's the so it kicks off from the sleep program when she says she's in trouble to find John Luke.
Right.
And I think, Jason, you were postulating that find John Luke was maybe Romulans had taken over the program.
Well, it was clear that the glitch shows that the program was hacked. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think we understand now it was hacked by Merrick.
No, right? I think it was hacked by the creator of the program. Like, it's a failsafe. Like, the mom program to be like, find John Luke is the failsafe, because who can protect synthetic life better than the one who defined the rights?
But who created the program? That wasn't Merrick?
I don't think it was. I think it's whoever Dad is, whoever the phantom father figure. Whoever that person is. It's not Maddox. It's not Narek. It's not anyone like that. It's whoever that mystery person is. I think it's going to be Brent Spinal in some soon role.
Yeah.
Again, the interesting thing about that is that when she says about Soji's calls and they only last 70 seconds each time and they monitor the actual transmissions and they go off the station. So she's actually beaming a signal off station. So someone is out there receiving that thing to beam back again. It's not just like a automated thing where you open the book and you get like a effectively like a hologram holodeck character that's talking to you and it's not actually going anywhere. So there is some information traveling out from that device that she uses. And obviously, so someone's definitely hacked that to get her to go and see Picard. She obviously doesn't recognize Picard, so hers hasn't been hacked or activated in that respect. So it's not like an inbuilt memory that if there's any trouble. So there's definitely something on that end that seems to suggest that she's been steered in that direction in episode one, or her sister was steered in that direction in episode one. But I don't think it can be the Romulans. I think it has to be the creator, like you say. It has to be somebody else. There has to be someone else there, because otherwise they would have done something similar.
Yeah. And to your point, Aid, when you're talking about the biology thing, she stabs herself. Like, she can feel pain. Data couldn't feel pain.
But there's no blood.
There's no blood, but she does stab herself to wake up.
But this addresses Aid's question about how organic is she? And the answer is not very, because she doesn't appear to have blood.
She does seem to have scratches on her when she comes out of the tunnels after...
That's right, yes.
On her forehead, yeah. So there is definitely some superficial damage, yeah.
She's got some Terminator...
And also, one other point, because I know someone's going to write in. We have seen Data infected by a biological agent.
You'd be so lucky. If any of you are listening, please write in.
But we have seen Data infected by the Psi 2000 virus, where he himself got drunk.
Yes.
So there is although Data also comments in that episode, if you prick me, do I not leak?
Why not leak?
So there is some. There's always been a biological component of Data. I think it's just to the nth degree with Soji and Dodge.
Well, then the sister made that comment about being fully operational, or whatever the comment was. What was the line referring to Data being sexually active?
Oh yes, I'm fully
fully functional.
Multiple techniques.
Yeah, fully
functional, programmed in multiple techniques.
She needles Narek about that, calling Soji fully functional.
Yeah, that I didn't even catch that. That's a good callback.
So when we met Elnor in his first episode,
you mean the best character in Star Trek?
When we met the best character on this show, and it's funny because Jim, you were talking about the Dr. Girardi, and you were like, I wanted to like her because she's a sort of doe-eyed innocent. But now we understand that Elnor is the doe-eyed innocent on the show. That Girardi was just pretending to be the doe-eyed innocent, and in many ways, Elnor moves into that role as she moves out of it in episode 5, right?
I want in-budding and out-budding to be the new thing.
Yeah.
I want that to be like the phrase that catches on, like fully functional. Like, that used to be a t-shirt that some fans made around the time of those four seasons of Next Generation. I want in-budding to become a thing.
In-budding?
Okay. Not to be in-budding or anything.
I'm sorry. So Elnor, I had a thing I was going to talk about.
I totally missed the avatar. I'm sorry.
Nothing I was going to say, but other than talk about the ending of the episode, but now it's fled. But
I'm interested to see what's going to happen. Obviously, we've got Hugh and Elnor on the board.
Oh, yeah, that was it. So when we first met Elnor, the two of you both enlightened me on the fan theory, which you both ascribed to, that Elnor is Nerek's long lost brother.
Yeah.
And presumably, therefore, also his sister's long lost brother. That I know that we want them to not actually be brother and sister, but I think they probably are.
See, yeah. I'm not sure, because I'm now thinking, is it a sister thing, as in sister in the fraternity of this thing? And that's the kind of thing I'm going for now. It just seems to be like almost like an address to give someone in the same order.
Yeah.
I really want to subscribe to that, because I know I talked about that a lot in the previous episode.
Yeah.
But when he says little brother, like the specificity of saying little brother I was like, oh, well, maybe the Romulans, because they are an offshoot of the Vulcans, and there could only have been X number of them that dissented and got into spaceships and left Vulcan, maybe sure. They don't have an incest taboo, because that's the only way they can propagate those species.
Yeah.
Well, regardless, that was the theory. So it's interesting now that as soon as Soji leaves the cube and Nerek's plot is basically over. I mean, Nerek's got nothing to do now, right? His sole plot was to find out where the synthetic's homeworld is, and he was romancing Soji.
Mm-hmm.
And now he got that information and she's left. So his story arc is over, except conveniently his brother has just about to show up.
Yeah.
Giving him a brand new subplot. I'm like, oh shit, now how am I going to reconcile myself with my long lost brother?
Are you saying the show is going to make me like Nerek because the show is going to save the best character ever created on Star Trek? Is that what you're saying right now?
You know, all I know is that one day, Elnor is just going to call everybody in the room on their shit. He's going to be like, okay, you're lying and you actually mean this, and you're lying about this, and you're lying about that, and all of you are a bunch of lying liars who lie. It's going to be glorious.
the scene where he comments on Girardi's and Rios's tension.
Yes.
Was just perfect for me. I think the acknowledgement of, this is making me uncomfortable.
There's a couple of lines like that in this episode where we understand one of Elnor's abilities. Like, if I were writing up Elnor as a character, this show tells me he has a huge sense motive stat, that he can just tell he can tell when people are hiding things, and he can tell what they're feeling, because he knows, he's so used to, like, he's so aware of everybody's inner thoughts and their ability to deceive all the time. And it's a great unexpected ability, which you know is going to come in handy, because Elnor needs to, for story reasons, Elnor needs to be able to do more than just simply kill people good. Right? Like, it's hard to write that character if the only thing he's good for is killing people. But if he's good at killing people and also reading people's emotions, I can write a whole episode with that, right?
What you're saying is Deanna Troi was missing the fact that she was also the secret mortal on the Enterprise.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting about it also with him is he going to try and adapt and become the Data character, where he tries to take on aspects and actually start lying as well, or is he going to purely adhere to that thing all the way through? Because I can see there's going to be a situation where he's going to be, oh yeah, you're definitely telling the truth now. Oh yeah, and it will be a lie. So I reckon that will be an aspect at some point.
Yeah,
at some point he's going to lie to Bacon.
Yeah,
fail Bacon. Much the same way Seven of Nine, to bring it back to that episode, lies to Bacon so that someone can keep hope and keep faith.
Yeah, it certainly the obvious thing to do is to test Elnor.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm a little bit more optimistic. I think that, I mean, he's gonna be put in a lot of positions where he needs to or even wants to lie. But I'm curious to see how he responds to that. I actually want to see it. And if he does lie, I'm interested to see if he has to do some sort of compensation or penance for that. Like, he surely cannot be the first member of his order who has been forced or chose to tell a lie. Especially when, for example, well, if I lie, but I do that so that I can save people's lives. Like that's the balance. Like, okay, I can save Picard's life, or I can save the life of the crew if I lie. So I choose to lie because I don't want to murder them. Mm-hmm. So there must be a rule for this. Like his order must have thought of, they must have a system for this.
Yeah, at some point, the no lying rule and the I have sworn myself to become rule is going to collide.
Well, and he broke. I love the end of this episode because Elnor comes to the rescue, but Picard told him you can't leave the ship, and he's also forced Elnor to swear the you won't kill anyone oath. Elnor kills three Romulans
in
two seconds in this episode, and Picard did not give him permission to do that. So he may always have to tell the truth, but he doesn't have to always obey his oath. He's already violated it. Mm-hmm. And there's that, and I love the bit where he's like, "Well, I swore my sword to you, to your cause. Well, I release you. I refuse your release." Like that's. He's a total teenager. Like, well, I refuse to be let go.
Well, the best thing about that scene, like after he does the heroic thing, like after he does the hero, you know, the white knight riding on his horse moment and kills those three Romulans, Picard begs him to come with him.
Yes, that's right.
And then there's that moment between the two of them where Picard says, I'm not, you know, I don't want to leave you. And Elnor goes, you know, you have no idea how much joy that brings me.
It fills my heart with joy to hear you say that. And he says it smiling. And I love that Elnor is just so upfront and honest about everything. Like, it's great.
I don't want it to be like he winds up being, like, I know that at some point in the show's history, in the show's run, he's going to have to lie. And the only one he can really lie to will have to be Picard for Picard's benefit. Like, narratively, it just feels like that's going to be the focus of that.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's just like sort of a wasted opportunity. But yeah, she's just such a great character. And the fact that the episode ends with on black, you know, please, my friends, choose live.
And
it's such a great moment.
The first time he says that, it's just a line. Like he actually knows this guy, and he's actually friends with them. The senator, the ex-Roman senator that he kills. Like maybe they actually are friends.
Yeah.
But this time, now he said it twice. Now it's his tagline.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Now he's gonna say it like it's gonna be like I have spoken.
T over hot.
And what I love about it is that we get that beautiful shot of Hugh with a phaser or a disruptor,
mm-hmm.
and Elnor with his sword, and the wall slides up, and we don't even see the Romulans coming, and it's please friends choose to live. We know that he's gonna just massacre the fuck out of these Romulans. Like he's gonna fill a whole hallway with dead Romulans. But what I love about it is that he says friend.
Mm-hmm.
These Romulans he has never met. And Elnor cannot lie. Which means that to Elnor, everyone he meets is his friend. Until they're proven not to be.
Like that's just great. Like that right there. Like I hadn't thought about that my friends bit. Because it could be like he says that to all Romulans, like the Quat'Malon offerings to all Romulans. And like I would love to see him say that to someone who's not a Romulan.
Yes.
I like your readings more than I like my reading, which was all Romulans are my friends.
Well, maybe you're right though. I had not thought about that. He has not yet said it to a non-Romulan, but then he's only killed Romulans. Right? He's only
put him in a room with Cardassians and let's see if he does the whole line.
There you go. Let's put him in a room with some Cardassians. Anyway, it was a great finish to the episode. And I love because Chabon has written a lot of adventure fiction. He loves to write that genre of adventure fiction. And he's spoken very passionately about how adventure fiction is derided as a kind of inferior literary form. But episodes like this really convey his knowledge of the genre and his willingness to revel in it. He doesn't need to show us the violence, but that heroic two against many scene with a cool tagline and a character and characters that we have come to love. I mean, Hugh and Elnor, we've all spent the last hour and a half talking about how awesome both of those two characters are. We don't want either of them to suffer, and we want them to just kick ass all day long. And it was, it's very satisfying and rewarding.
Yeah, because I say, originally, Hugh was a throwaway character.
Yeah.
Effectively, Hugh was like, oh, here we go. The coolest bad guys in Star Trek, and you're bringing the human element to it. Oh, you've ruined the Borg. And now it's like, actually, they've done real good, and I'm glad they've done something with him, rather than just kind of like, and they've obviously got, I assume it's the original actor, I believe it's the same. So, I mean, this guy obviously said, yeah, I'm willing to play that character again, because you've obviously done something with him, rather than just being, you know, the stompy bad guy or whatever. So it's really cool in that respect, yeah.
And his smile is just so infectious.
Isn't it great? Yeah.
For me, it was just like, oh, I'm so happy that John Luke gets this moment of human connection. Like, the only time he's connecting, physically connecting to someone who isn't trying to kill him, is this hug with that spawn. Like, right. That literally throws all of his preconceptions from False Contact, like when he kills Ensign Lynch, all of that gets thrown out the window, and it's like, oh, I was wrong.
Well, so we have solved the question of how are we going to meet Riker and Troy, because we're teleporting across the galaxy at the end of last episode, and that means we couldn't figure it out. Like, well, if he's on the ship or he's on the cube, but Riker and Troy are clearly in some sort of pastoral farm environment, like, where does he meet them? And so now,
one question about the teleporter as well.
Yeah.
He references the name of an alien race. Has that race been established as Star Trek?
Yeah, that was the
Voyager. I couldn't remember what it was. It was from a Voyager episode.
Yeah.
So they're going to going to a different quadrant, obviously in that tech with the effectively the transwarp teleporter. So obviously I don't think Riker gonna be there, but obviously they're gonna be able to get back somehow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think Picard selected the place. I think he's going to go to his number one.
Yeah.
And I think Reichel's going to have something to do. Like, it's not just going to be Reichel in the kitchen cooking. Like, we don't have a generations moment here, people.
Yeah.
Like, that may be how it opens, and I'll be okay with a little callback to that, because we've seen him washing dishes. I'm like, okay, you're doing a little tongue-in-cheek thing.
But we're talking about the scene in Star Trek Generations when Picard and Kirk finally meet, and Kirk is in the kitchen cooking.
Katarian eggs.
Yeah.
Dill. Excuse me? Dill. In the cabinet. I hate that scene so much I haven't memorized.
I'm surprised you don't love that movie more than anything. Because normally, like, scenes that are terrible, like, are in your top list, usually.
No, I'm not going to go down the generation.
All right.
That's just too easy for me. We'll be here for another 45 minutes. I'm sorry.
You escaped my trap today.
If you want to do like a post, if you want to do a post Space Force Picard generations talk, I'm totally down for that.
All right. Well, I understand that this is only four more episodes to go. So,
All
right. That might be our show.
I think we've gone through every episode from start to finish both times, I believe, yes.
All right, well, an hour and a half. So thank you, everyone, for listening. I'm Jason Tondro.
I'm Jim Seals.
And I am still Aid Smith.
And we'll see you next week on Space Force.